Okay, the meeting of the Civil Justice Committee will come to order. First one filled is Representative Hillstrom's 695, and I assume you move that.
Yes, this is here. House file 695 is asked that you recommend pass and be referred to the General Register. And Mr. Chair, I have the A1 amendment. Mr. Chair, in the other policy committee, there were two sections of the bill that were controversial, and so we're just taking them out.
Okay, and Representative Hillstrom moves the A1 amendment to get it in the language the author supports. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Hillstrom, go ahead and present your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to turn it over to my testifier to just be brief. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Becca Price. I'm here representing the Minnesota Association of County Officers, which includes the county recorders and the local registrars who administer this, the marriage statute. And this bill mostly makes housekeeping changes and a couple policy changes. And just to briefly go through the bill, in several places it makes changes to clarify that it's the local registrar, not the court administrator, who administers the law. That's some changes that weren't that made earlier when the statute was updated. It clarifies that the person performing the marriage has verified that the couple have a license, and that the people present for the marriage are the same people on the license. It also clarifies that the marriage license issued in Minnesota is to be used for marriages performed in Minnesota. Sometimes people living near a border state will purchase a license in Minnesota and then get married in the other state. And there was an AG's office, AG had asked a few years ago to have this clarified. I thought it would be a good idea to get that clarified in statute. It clarifies that both parties getting married must apply for the marriage license, but creates the process in case that person can't be present. Remove the requirements to issue two keepsake marriage certificates. Right now, when you get your license, or when you get your marriage certificates, you get three. One's the real one, and two are just for keepsakes, and they don't serve a purpose. Clarifies that the marriage certificate will be issued to the married couple. Clarifies that the person with felony cannot change their name through marriage without following the process currently in law. So I could change my name from Becca Price to Deborah Price currently in law, and we wanted to change that. It also establishes a minimum age for persons authorized to perform marriage. It says it at 21. Removes the requirement that the marriage application include any information about the children that the couple might have together. The information is collected, but it's never shared. And since it is private data, it requires special handling of the marriage application. We talked to the Department of Health about this. They're fine with that change. Requires that if an individual applying for a marriage license does not have a social security number, they have to certify that they don't have a social security number. This is the same requirement that we have right now with the driver's license application. And it requires that a premarital education verification be on letterhead and notarized. Right now, a couple participate in premarital education receives a discount of $70 on their marriage license, so we thought this seemed appropriate. Yep, that's it, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Is there anyone to testify against this bill? any questions? Okay, Representative Hillstrom renews her motion to pass House File 695 as amended and send it to General Register. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries.
Thank you, members.
Representative Davids. Is he, did he disappear? Or? Oh. Oh. Can he present the rest of his bill and explain it?
Yeah. Oh, we're not. No.
Well, this is as it passed Congress. What did you want, King? Mr. Peace in the Valley, have you reached it this time? I believe so, Mr. Chairman. Does somebody want to move Representative David's bill? I think we'll go ahead and discuss. Representative Mahoney, I think, was first. He's given it up, so Representative Jackson will.
Representative Jackson, he should help the insured, the underinsured people protect themselves.
Representative Davis, we're waiting for an amendment. Is that the one that you said in Commerce that you'd have before we got here or something?
Yes,
I remember that. That's the one. Okay. Why don't you present the bill and explain the amendment and the bill as amended, and then we'll take care of putting it on once we get it.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I had a great presentation with some pens here. but I can't be what happened last night, so we'll just let it go. I came prepared.
I'm prepared. You got enough.
I forgot the amendment, but I brought the pen. So, okay, there's an amendment that's been copied or is being copied that you'll have shortly. You have the bill, House File 811, before you. I'll explain what the changes are that we've worked with the Guarantee Association, and I believe that the main issue we're talking about here is we're removing a penalty. And so I believe that's the main issue. But basically what we're doing here is the Minnesota Guarantee Fund is a fund that is there to protect policyholders that have life insurance policies, annuities, and the health insurance. And under current law, they have an indexing process. If you buy a life insurance policy or an annuity, your agent will bring a sheet out to you when he delivers the policy or give it to you at the time that he or she's writing up the application, and it says that you have $100,000 coverage by the Minnesota Guarantee Fund for cash values of a life insurance policy, $100,000 for an annuity, $300,000 death benefit, and there's some other coverages listed in there. That's what you'll hand out. That's what we have, but that's actually not correct because it's indexed. Right now, today, the cash value is $130,000, the death benefit $410,000, but that's not what the client receives. So what we're doing is with this bill, as the amendment will go, we're basically going to $250,000 cash value for annuities, $130,000 cash value for life insurance policies, $500,000 death benefit for life insurance policies, and we're taking away the indexing. The one provision that my amendment would remove is a provision that says under current law, if an insurance agent talks about the guarantee fund before the sale is made, that's a violation. I believe it's a petty misdemeanor. Counsel could probably correct me on that if I'm wrong. But there's a penalty for an agent at the point of sale to tell a customer that the guarantee fund exists and what the coverages are in the guarantee fund. I've never quite understood that because what's happening is an agent is out there, and if they talk about the guarantee fund beforehand, they're violating the law. And what this bill does, other than changing the numbers, is it says that an agent could talk about the guarantee fund up front with folks. If a client asks about, well, is there FDIC insurance, the agent has to say, no, there's no FDIC insurance, but you would say that there is the Minnesota Guarantee Fund. The client brought it up. What we're saying is that if an agent would mention the guarantee fund during a sales presentation, that's not against the law. So that's, I believe, the provision of the bill that would be of interest to this committee. The bill passed through Commerce with, I believe, no dissenting vote on the numbers as far as coverage. So I stand for any questions.
I represent Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative David, why did they ban it, make it a penalty against the law in the first place? I mean, is there a reason for that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Mahoney, the reason being is they're saying that an agent from a low-rated company could come out and say, you know, we've got this good deal. You don't really have to worry about the stability of the company because it's covered by the guarantee fund. I would argue in this state with the fine commerce department we have that those companies had better be shut down. They better not be out there, and there better not be agents from companies such as that approved in the state. That being said, in with that provision, it's kind of like going into a bank and banning them from having any signage or discussing FDIC insured deposits on an account. It doesn't make any sense. Anytime I go in a bank, it's on the door, it's on the teller's stalls there, whatever you call them, on their forehead, FDIC insured. We just want to make it so that an insurance agent is not committing a crime if they describe to somebody what the law already says.
Representative Davids, with regard to your pins, I was told last night that people that had been here a long time said it was the most effective and cheapest crop they'd ever seen.
Well, Mr. Chairman, to that point, it was extremely effective, but it was pretty cheap because these are $100 pens. So I was trying to go, it was $100,000.
So these two weren't quite $100?
They were very effective, Mr. Chairman.
I said cheapest.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, it actually did help because I actually understood what you're talking about. I never have before. So, I was extremely impressed. And I know I'm not helping myself here.
Representative Davis, your bill is being laid over until next year.
Pretty impossible inclusion.
I'm going to take it off the table.
That was good, though.
Representative Davis, are the amendments here?
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Davis, what is the number of the amendment?
It's the TP-A01 amendment.
Okay.
And Mr. Chairman,
I will move, or Representative Mahoney will move the A01 amendment. Everybody, we won't vote till they're out.
And Mr. Chairman, if I could speak just a little further to them, please.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In visiting with the Guarantee Fund, they were concerned about the penalty. They didn't want agents talking about the Guarantee Fund, and I was quite adamant, actually, that be changed, because, like I said, I can't imagine why we're making it a crime for someone to explain to someone what the law says. And if you look on the amendment on the first page, it goes from $300,000 death benefit on life insurance to $500,000, $130,000 cash value, $500,000 health benefits, $250,000 annuity cash surrender value, net cash surrender value, $410,000 present value of an annuity on a structured settlement. That's the money that's being paid on a monthly or quarterly or annual basis. And I just want to make sure, Mr. Chairman, we have this right here. What I'm looking for, okay, Mr. Chairman, page 4, line 4.8 through 4.9, starting after insurance period, a person violating this section is guilty of a misdemeanor. We're taking the part out that says it's a crime to inform people what the law currently says.
Okay.
And I'm not aware of any opposition at this point.
Is there anybody against this, wants to testify against it? Okay. All in favor of the A01 amendment to get it in the shape the author wants, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Seeing no further discussion, Representative Mahoney moves House File 811 as amended, and I believe it goes to the general...
I think it was Representative Jackson.
I'm sorry. That's right. Representative Mahoney withdrew. I apologize. Representative Jackson renews her motion to pass House File 811 as amended and send it to the General Register. Is that correct?
That was my motion.
Okay. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carried.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members, and just I thought that we had this stuff in, and it was they were going to pass out the amendment that they received prior to the committee. So I scrambled around this morning to get the amendment so we passed out, but it was already being worked on.
You're just like confusing us.
Did the bill pass? Thank you, Mr. Chair members. Thank you.
Better get out of here.
Representative Davids, you got two bills out of this committee this year. You are incredibly fortunate.
I am.
Thank you. Hey, Greg, please.
No, we're not doing that.
Representative Portman, can you get... We're ready. We're ready.
We're not doing that.
Okay.
Representative Portman, I guess first you're doing this is 2082.
2082.
the Uniform Disclaimer of Property Interests Act. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. You may recognize our witness. He was with us last night at the tail end of the
meeting. Hours ago.
I just stayed overnight here.
You're so exciting. Representative Fortman, I assume you moved the 2082, and I believe it goes to the General Register?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, go ahead and present your bill. Or do you want to go right to, was it Mr. Nelson?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Scott Nelson. I'm the chair of the Legislative Issues Committee for the Probate and Trust section. And we did work on the contents of this bill over a period of about 3 years. So we have done some extensive work on this. It is based on a uniform law that was drafted actually initially back in 1978, and they've revised it twice since then, most recently in 2006. So we have taken into account all of the recent amendments that have been made to the uniform law. But basically what we're proposing in this bill is to replace our existing disclaimer statutes. We do have, it goes back in common law, but we do have two statutes on our books right now. One that handles disclaimers basically during lifetime, and another that handles disclaimers for people that inherit property after a person dies. And this would basically combine all of the disclaimer rules into one statute, which would make it easier for practitioners and for the public to know what the rules are and how to handle disclaimers rather than having two separate statutes. What the bill will also do is basically update some of the rules involved in the disclaimer area. And before I get into any quick information about the bill itself, I just want to give you a quick example of how disclaimers work if you're not familiar with those. A typical example might be where we're counseling a client who, let's say, wants to give $20,000 to a charity upon death, but they're not sure that their spouse is going to have enough resources to live on after they pass away. So what we might suggest to them is that they, for example, let's say it's a life insurance policy, a $20,000 death benefit, we might suggest designate your spouse as the primary beneficiary in the life insurance and designate the charity as the secondary beneficiary. And then when you pass away, your spouse can decide, does he or she need the $20,000, or is he or she okay with it going to charity? If he or she is okay with it going to charity, they can simply disclaim the right to receive the $20,000, and then it goes by law directly to the charity that you've designated as the secondary beneficiary. So that would be an example of where we might counsel an individual to use a disclaimer arrangement. It's most frequently used for tax purposes. There's actually a disclaimer provision in the Internal Revenue Code that has very specific rules which also relate back to the state statute where the resident resides or where they were living when they passed away. And basically the Internal Revenue Code requires that you do the disclaimer in conformance with the state statute. So we get back to the state statute and making sure that if people are making disclaimers for tax purposes, that they will also make sure that they follow the state statute. The other example that is, we have run into some problems with our existing disclaimer statute, and part of this proposal is to respond to that issue. Perhaps an easy example for that would be, typical, let's say, husband and wife. If one of them passes away, sometimes they'll put money into a trust, and they'll say, I want the trust to pay my spouse the income for the rest of his or her life, so they'll have the resources to live on. And then, when they pass away, whatever's left in the trust goes to their children. So that's a typical trust that we set up upon a person's death. Well, we've had a situation not too long ago where a spouse petitioned the court to disclaim their interest in the trust because they felt they really didn't need the income any longer, and they wanted the trust just to go ahead and pass to the children. And the local court here actually refused the petitioner's request based on what they read into our existing statute that basically they believe said that you have to make the disclaimer within 9 months after the trust was established. And this, of course, was beyond the 9-month period, which is the normal period that you are required to make the disclaimer for federal tax purposes. And they, you know, they weren't concerned about the tax issues here. They just wanted to disclaim their interest in the trust and pass it on to the children, but the court wouldn't allow them to do that under existing statute. So one of the main changes in the statute that is proposed here today would allow you to make, it would make clear that you can disclaim an interest even if it's not going to qualify for tax purposes. So it basically is expanding or clarifying, we think, the issue of whether you can disclaim an interest even if it's not done within the 9 months required by the Internal Revenue Code for tax purposes. There are some other changes that I'll just go through very briefly, and certainly we'll open it up for any questions that you have. Basically, from our current law, this new statute would, as I mentioned, eliminate the 9-month time limit for that normally is required for tax purposes, so you can disclaim at any time. It would bar disclaimers if you're insolvent. That can be an issue. You know, for example, if you're if you owe creditors and you're going to receive an inheritance, basically the law would prohibit you from disclaiming so that you could avoid paying your creditors with the inheritance. That obviously is an issue that can come up quite often. It allows disclaimers of future interest. It allows disclaimers of jointly held property. It allows a trustee to disclaim property that might be scheduled to be distributed to the trust. Typically, again, that would be for tax purposes. It allows disclaimers of powers of appointment and other powers that a person might hold over another's trust. Typically, that's what a power of employment involves. It allows disclaimers of powers held in a fiduciary capacity. It eliminates recording of disclaimers in the district court. Under our current statute, you do have to record the disclaimer, and it has been somewhat of a burden on the district courts because in many cases they don't have a file for a particular case. But if you have a situation where you want to make a disclaimer, they have to open a file just to have a disclaimer on record. They usually don't, you know, do anything with it except record it. So we've eliminated the requirement that you file it with the district court. You basically have to deliver it to whoever is the whoever owns the property or has possession of the property that you're disclaiming. And then, of course, we still have some provisions in there for making sure that any disclaimer involving real estate would comply with the real estate statutes and the recording requirements for those types of disclaimers. I believe those are kind of the highlights of the act itself, and I don't know if maybe I'd stop there for now and see if there's any questions.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can a person disclaim, let's say a person in long-term care has spent on all their assets or on Medicaid actually, can they disclaim an asset then? Because following their death, the Medicaid would go back after assets.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, there's actually two protections in a situation where an individual is receiving medical assistance. One is, again, if they're insolvent, this statute would preclude the disclaimer directly. And then the second is in Section 256B, which covers medical assistance. They have specific provisions there that specifically reference disclaimers as an, I can't remember the technical term that they use, but basically it's an improper transfer for medical assistance purposes. So it basically just qualifies the individual from receiving medical assistance based on their formulas. It's treated as if they made a gift. for medical assistance purposes. So then you, you know, get into the improper transfer rules under 256B.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Jackson.
Page 1.1 to 1.13, I'm just confused of why the beneficiary designation means an instrument other than a trust amendment or the, an instrument creating a trust. Where do we pick up trusts then?
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, there is a separate section dealing with trusts, and trust in line 2.3 in that same section, and then if we go to I believe when you get into the body of the statute itself, it talks about disclaimers of beneficiary designations separately from disclaimers of interest in trusts. And I'll see if I can find that quickly here while we're... I know there's basically a laundry list of disclaiming different interests, and I'm trying to find that section here.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if it's section 14 on page 7, line 723 to 726, in the case of a disclaimer of an interest in a testamentary trust.
Well, that's under the delivery of filing.
That's the fiduciary, not the beneficiary.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I don't see it up. I know that that issue has been very carefully worked on in this bill because that was, like I say, one of the issues that we had started with when we began this project was the issue of disclaiming an interest in a trust.
The testifier, do you recall why trusts were eliminated from the definition for beneficiary designation?
Also.
I see references to trust all over this, except in the definition for beneficiary designation.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I actually believe this was taken directly from the uniform law draft that we started with, and it has been maintained that way through the amendments that have been made to the uniform law. But what I'm looking for is that, you know, there should be language in here that talks about disclaiming different property interests, and they do differentiate between, you know, disclaiming a beneficiary designation, which again is, as in the example that I used at the beginning, where you have a life insurance policy and you have a beneficiary designation, and then differentiating that from disclaiming an interest in a trust. And I, like I said, I believe in the body of the statute itself, we treat those distinctly as far as how you handle the disclaimer for each of those.
Representative Olin?
Yeah, just a quick question on point, Mr. Chair. Isn't there a separate, isn't probably got something to do with the fact that there's a separate uniform trust law on trust too?
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we do have a separate trust, Section 501B, but again, this new act would cover disclaimers of interest in trust. It would not be supplanted by any of the provisions in 501B that we have. Basically, this would replace the disclaimer provisions that are in 501B at this time.
Representative Fortman, what I think maybe we'll do is ask questions and then have Mr. Nelson go back and try and find it, and then we can do your other bill maybe and come back to this.
And Mr. Chair and members, I think, though, maybe the definition of beneficiary designation, I don't know we can go on and talk briefly about 1228 if you'd like.
I think it would be better use of time rather than having the whole committee sit here while he's reading through it. The chair will temporarily lay over 2082. Representative Hortman, I assume you move 1228 for passage and referral to the general register. Is that correct?
So that's not it.
That's not it.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, they're referencing Section 10, which does allow the trustee to make the disclaimer, but I know we're looking more specifically at the beneficiary of the trust being able to disclaim.
Right. I think what we'll do is go ahead, Representative Portman, with your other bill, and then Mr. Nelson can try to look this up.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Davies is here to talk briefly about House File 1228.
Okay, Mr. Davies.
Were you a representative and then a senator?
No, I was never a representative.
So I guess the correct title.
He was never a member here. He was.
They wouldn't let me in.
He had the robes and the powdered wigs and things.
So the correct title is senator.
Mr. Davies, go ahead.
Chairman, members of the committee, my title today is Commissioner on Uniform State Laws. We submitted to the Bar Association last summer this big fat bill and asked them to start studying it. And I prodded them several times, but they couldn't finish their study for this session of the legislature. They indicate that they are going to be ready next year with their affirmance of the quality and their few, we hope, changes in the Uniform Act. But what has happened is that the Uniform Laws Commission has been accumulating over the last few years a number of acts relating to probate law, and we decided to put all those acts together. Do you want me to run through the article by article, Mr. Chairman?
Briefly,
okay. The first article is
Amendment Mahoney, I guess, wants you to go word by word.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
I was commenting on an oxymoron briefly with an attorney.
I'm real brief, Mr. Chairman. And
Mr. Chair?
Representative Drifthouse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious. I want to maybe just get a little clarification. It sounds like, according to Mr. Davies, the bar is going to review this yet, and so we're really not going to be reviewing it ourselves in earnest today. Does it make sense for us to delve into the details of this? I think many of us and our staff would like a chance to take a look at it as well, and I don't know how productive use of our time that
might
be.
I believe what Representative Hartman was saying, this will be a very short informational hearing. I think that's what I interpreted your statement as, and they're nodding yes. So,
thank you.
We're just going to get a little hint of what we're going to. And the advantage of this is if you have issues with what he talks about, you can participate with him, Representative Hartman, and the Bar Association over the interim. So go ahead, Mr. Davies.
Mr. Chairman, the members of the committee, the first article relates to amendments directed to the Uniform Probate Code, namely the intestacy section. That is the section where the public is guessing what people would want in their will if they made a will when they didn't make a will. And relates a bit to the children of the new biology, to the extent that it's just unavoidable that we address that. Previous spouses, since divorce, are included now in a number of other changes. The Uniform Tax Deed Apportionment Act is an act that fills in a blank that a lawyer might have overlooked in saying which beneficiary has to pay an estate tax. That's a sort of a subtle problem that sometimes is overlooked. The most important part of this, in my view, is the Uniform Power of Attorney Act. It's a very basic change in that law because it makes every power of attorney a durable power of attorney unless indicated otherwise, or whether the function or the purpose of the power of attorney has passed. So that is being very well approved, received around the country, and is a very significant change in the law. The Non-Person Account Act is just like the two people have both are in the named and in the count, there's a right of survivorship. And that's it, and I hope I haven't taken too much time.
No, I think Mr. Nelson's ready too, so that was good timing. Representative Weston.
Mr. Chair, just on the issue of power of attorney, if I heard you correctly, the proposal is to default to a durable power of attorney unless it's otherwise specified. What's being well received? What's kind of the impetus behind that?
There's two main impetuses that I can remember at the moment. One is This is a guardianship device that is being used more and more and more. Somebody gives the power of attorney to a family member, and then that family member is able to look after their affairs even after they lose the capacity themselves. And the problem then is that the person cannot make a new power of attorney because they don't have the capacity to do that. The other main purpose of this amendment is to put pressure on financial institutions, particularly, to accept the power of attorney that's already been executed. One of the problems that lawyers have is that you go to a bank with the power of attorney that your client has exercised, and the bank says, no, we want it on our form. So you have to go back to your client and get the a new power of attorney executed, and that's a real problem if the client has lost capacity in the meantime.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Weston.
Mr. Chair, you actually raised a good point there. I just recently had that experience with actually a government, federal government office that said the same thing. They want the durable power of attorney on their form. How are we going to require that absolutely they have to acknowledge the durable power of attorney, or how will we avoid that scenario that you laid out? The financial institution says, if they insist they want it on their form versus recognizing another durable power of attorney, how is that going to be handled? And how would it be handled with the federal government?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we have declared in here that you're supposed to accept the power of attorney that's on the standard form that's set out in this act. Now, when it comes to federal government, we can't make them, but we sure have encouraged them as much as we felt we could legally do. But to have the experience that we're trying to, the problem that we're trying to avoid with the redo of the act.
Representative Jackson.
To the testifier, isn't there a requirement, maybe it's reproduced in here, that a mandate that if third parties don't honor that they're liable for damages?
Mr. Chairman, we do have a provision like that in the Act.
And Mr. Chairman, I have a question about the execution of wills. That was there much discussion or concern about wills that are notarized but not witnessed? I mean, personally, I found it to be a real safeguard to have two more people in the room.
Yes, Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Dave.
In Article 1, there is some material on the execution of wills, and there's the elimination of there's the recognition, if I remember right, of a, I was not prepared to testify, you have to understand it. There's recognition of a notarized will, but there's not a requirement of a notarized will.
Mr. Davies, you're saying then we're abolishing the witness requirement then?
No, there's a requirement that they be witnessed, but they can be witnessed by a notary.
Oh, so we don't...
I'm
sorry. There's just one witness in the notary, you're saying.
Right now there's... Do I have to find out the answer to that question?
No, I guess we can... We'll live in suspense until next year when we hear this.
Mr. Chairman.
There are a lot of issues in here, and I did not expect you to give me any time.
Representative Fortman, we didn't vote on your motion yet, so I think the best would be to withdraw it rather than laying it over for 9 months.
Oh, 1228, yes. I didn't know that I made a motion, but Mr. Chair, I appreciate the committee's time because it's a 90-page proposed act, and what we want to do is make sure that the Bar Association lets us know what they don't like or could get to work on it so that we can figure out whether we're going to move forward with it or not.
Right.
Mr. Chairman, I have to say, there's a lot of really good stuff in here.
And I'm sure every member will have it memorized by next year.
I'll get somebody else to do the presentation, Mr. Chairman.
We'll
be here.
every member will be able to make the presentation next year. They'll study it over the interim.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Will recall House File 2082. Mr. Nelson, you've found the answer now?
Yes, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for your patience and allowing me to take a look at this. But what I needed to do was step back. The definition referred to on beneficiary designation, I believe, is really just targeted at Section 14, where we talk about delivery, and it differentiates between who do you deliver the disclaimer to if it's a disclaimer of a beneficiary designation versus who do you deliver the disclaimer to if you're disclaiming an interest in a trust. And basically deals with disclaimers of interest in a trust is Section 8, which is disclaimer of interest in property, and that just generally covers any type of interest that you might have in property, whether it's as a beneficiary designation, as a beneficiary of a trust, as a joint owner of an asset. And then we have Sections 9, 10, 11, and 12 that deal with specific issues that we run into with joint survivorship property, disclaimer of interest by the trustee, disclaimers of powers of appointment, and then some miscellaneous items in Section 12. But basically the general disclaimer section is Section 8, and that covers all interests that an individual or a beneficiary might have in property. And basically the definition in Section 1 is important, like I say, when you get to Section 14, where we talk about delivery. Specifically in Section 14, if you look at lines 7.23, which deals with disclaimers of an interest in the testamentary trust, which is a trust set up upon death, line 7.3, which is disclaimers of an interest in an inter vivos trust, which is a trust that an individual establishes during lifetime, and then section line 8.8, which is a disclaimer of an interest as a beneficiary designation.
Mr. Nelson, when you said line 7.3, did you mean 7.30?
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
Representative Jackson.
On line 8.8, there's a reference to a beneficiary designation. However, because beneficiary designation on page 1 at 1.12 does not include trust, then are we to conclude that that section of delivery or filing is not for trust and we refer only to 7.23 and following?
Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Jackson, I believe if I'm not answering your question correctly, certainly let me know, but I believe Section 14 has separate delivery requirements, and basically if you're disclaiming a beneficiary designation, then you deliver your disclaimer according to the provision in line 8.8, but if you're disclaiming an interest in a trust, then you deliver your disclaimer as required in line 7.23 and 7.30, depending on whether it's a testamentary trust or an inter vivos trust. So in the delivery section, we've, you know, specified who do you deliver it to, and that's where the definition, so we're trying to clarify that if you're disclaiming a beneficiary designation, we're not talking about a beneficiary designation in a trust. We're talking about a beneficiary designation such as in a life insurance policy, an annuity, or a retirement plan. That's typically where you would see the beneficiary designation.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Jackson, did you? Okay. Seeing no other discussion, Representative Portman, renews her motion to pass House File 2082 and send it to the House floor. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. And we are adjourned.